The Meaning of Geranium from The Secret Language of Plants by Andrina, read by Sam Gabriel, based on the works of J.K. Rowling. Chapter 18. It's Always Somebody Else's Fault. It is a sad and disheartening truth that very often the evils of this world don't come from truly wicked people so much as they come from idiots. The idiots, the thoughtless, the ones who didn't think that, who didn't mean to, the ones who do the thing and ruin everything. Evil people plot, idiots just ruin things. This story features two such idiots. Idiot number one was Lachlan Ramasanta. Ramasanta was a werewolf. This had little to do with his idiot status, no matter how much Wizarding Society wanted to believe that all lycanthropes were uneducated barbarians. Remus Lupin was an intellectual and scholar, and Fenrir Greyback had quite a lot of smarts about him, even if he chose to use them in the worst ways. Ramasanta, however, was an idiot, and his lack of studies only aggravated the problem. He also had troll and giant ancestry, and supposedly he was a born werewolf rather than a turned one, which was extremely rare. How he had come to be was a mystery few wanted to investigate. Ramasanta was big and strong, perhaps bigger than Greyback, and he was an amazing specimen. He was, as it is often the case with idiots, very comfortable with violence. Much as in the case of the Karos, it was one of the few things in life he was good at. He had naturally come to follow Voldemort's movement, even if by all rights he should have been one of the first to be exterminated given his lineage. But of course he was very strong and good at following orders if they were phrased with short, simple words, and they had to do with breaking things or inflicting pain on someone. He was, in a word, useful, and those who were useful to the cause got a reprieve. In the end, it wasn't so much about cleaning the line, but about being on top and making those below acknowledge that you deserved to be on top. Ramasanta had been in a band of snatchers for a long time, breaking doors and chasing people down as instructed by a polite and civilized Death Eater called Thornton. It's not wrong or violent if someone civilized tells you to do it because they know the difference better. Only said Death Eater was currently recovering from his injuries after their last mission went a tiny bit wrong. Nobody dead, but everybody injured with varied severity. Ramasanta had actually saved Thornton's life, pulling him from a fire and taking a couple of curses meant for him, but that was little trouble for him. He healed quickly, and he didn't care much about pain anyway. Pain had been a constant in his life, so even though he could feel it, he hardly paid any attention to it, just as he didn't think about breathing or how his tongue sat in his mouth. Pain was nothing. What Ramasanta was feeling acutely was the absence of a master, someone to give him orders. He was not so very stupid that he couldn't see that he had to prove his usefulness constantly. Besides, life was easier when he had someone to tell him what to do. Thinking for himself was full of possibilities for failure, while orders were orders. You follow the orders, and everything was fine. He had been following orders for a long time now. He had, however, not kept current with the news. Not his fault. The news were complicated, and they kept changing. He could hardly be expected to know what was happening around him. It was enough that he understood orders enough to carry them out. Should he also know about consequences, or about changing one's opinion when new information was provided? About subtle games of power and influence? This was a man who thought that hitting someone with a wrench was already elaborate torture. How was he supposed to understand that sometimes people said one thing and meant another? All he knew was that at some point, weeks and weeks ago, maybe months, Bellatrix Lestrange had made it known that she did not trust Severus Snape, and that she would like more information about his actions in Hogwarts. Of course, Bella wasn't so careless as to say so explicitly, but there had been the implication that she would be very grateful, both with Amicus Caro and with Peter Pettigrew, if they delivered anything that would ruin Snape. Lachlan Ramasanta had paid attention to that. Mostly because Thornton had explained it to him using simple words. He had not paid attention to how powerful and influential Severus Snape had become. A master move, considering he spent most of his time secluded at Hogwarts and therefore had little opportunity to play the intrigue games in Voldemort's court. The fact that Severus Snape was one of Voldemort's favorites and most beloved servants went well over Omasanta's head, just as he had not paid attention to the very public change of attitude of Bellatrix towards Snape. Neither did he know that the topic of the moment, what people really cared about, was finding Tonks and learning what happened to Mulciber and getting revenge for the Avery's deaths. That was like three different names, too much. More subtle things, like the rumors that there was a secret player, a knight dressed in mist and gray who didn't play with the Order yet worked against Voldemort, were completely lost on him. People didn't like to consider those rumors of a rogue element in any case. Thinking about his motivations and interests, about why that person was so independent, was too distressing. So, despite Snape's wonderful status and Bellatrix's well-known new interests, Romasanta didn't think to try and capture Sirius Black by himself, or Nymphadora Tonks, or Kingsley Shacklebolt, or anyone from the top 10 of the list, really. No, Lachlan Romasanta was an idiot, and as an idiot he followed the months-old request and decided to enter the impenetrable fortress in case he found some dirty laundry that Bellatrix would like to know about. This was profoundly stupid, but what do you want? This is an idiot's story. Idiot number two was Ernie McMillan, who to this day was convinced that he had been perfectly justified in his actions. Family came first, after all. And everyone else was being unnecessarily mean. He had tried this approach with the Slytherins first, citing that he had been threatened and didn't have a choice, and therefore he should not be ostracized. This only goes to show what kind of idiot Ernie was. Even if his academic performance spoke otherwise, because you couldn't just tell a Slytherin that there was no choice. Finding alternatives was their defining trait, together with ambition. They had also all faced severe threats to their families and from their families. Many of them had been disinherited, and they had spent a year thinking that Draco, their silver prince, had been murdered. They were not the best audience to tell about family pressure at the moment. Ernie had spent the rest of his sixth year in Hogwarts in the infirmary. At first he had legitimate causes to be there because he kept getting hexed or punched in the face when Ginny was involved. Later he just cited a general ill feeling, and Madame Pomfrey allowed him to stay because it was true that he could hardly show his face outside without someone insulting him at the very least. He had returned to his seventh year with a bit more confidence. Dumbledore was dead, the Dark Lord was in power, and even if his family hadn't reaped much benefit from Ernie's little act, it was still more than most. He had been sure that soon people would come to him looking for his friendship, and that many others would have to face a choice equally difficult. Not that it was a choice, no, Ernie had no other option. They would all realize how stupid and cruel they had been, and how pointless it was to fight against people like Voldemort. He had returned expecting them to apologize. And then Snape, of all people, had turned out to be a rogue player and not a Death Eater at all, never mind the brand on his arm. Generally, Ernie would be glad about that, because he didn't actually like Voldemort, it was just that he didn't think they could win, and they wouldn't get anywhere by opposing him. It was better, he thought, to accept the situation and try to make the best out of it. Fighting the Dark Lord would only earn them their deaths. However, he rarely gave much time and energy to such abstract thoughts. Ernie's focus was on the here and now, the close and immediate. Even more important than the war and the rise of Voldemort was Ernie's school experience. He thought they were still treating him very unfairly, even if they had all stopped cursing and hexing him. For the first 2 weeks, he had loitered around the infirmary, thinking that perhaps if he were to wake up the Carrows, he would win something for sure, and then everyone would be begging to be his friend. That would get everyone to stop talking bad about him. However, Madame Pomfrey had forbidden him from returning unless he had an obvious and demonstrable illness. Ernie had toyed with the idea of hurting himself so he could get back in there and keep trying, but he didn't have enough courage, and soon he had forgotten about it. The plan was too far-reaching in any case. What he wanted was for people to admit that he wasn't that bad. He was a good person, he really was, and it was very unfair that everyone was acting as if they were better than him. "It's not like I had any choice," Ernie would moan to whoever had come close enough to him. "This is all so unfair. They would have done the same. Bunch of hypocrites." Maurice, the 50-something-year-old squib currently sitting in front of him, gave him a black stare. He hadn't had much to say about his family, good or bad, since he barely had any contact with them until 2 months ago when his niece knocked on his house in the middle of the night and told him to leave, because she had heard in the ministry that there would be a raid in the morning. That'd have been nice. He hoped she hadn't gotten in too much trouble. He coughed noncommittally and went back to his book. He was tired after a long day cleaning and oiling the carriages, and he just wanted a bit of peace. If he had known that the Hufflepuff room would be so crowded, he would have stayed by the carriage house. Sometimes he could see the horses there, and he liked how they always begged for a treat. "They were threatening my family," Ernie muttered. "Even a squib should understand that you had to honor your family."
"Oh, deary me, were they?"
If cobras had a voice with which to speak, they would sound like Cho Chang did at that moment. She had been sitting on the other side of the Hufflepuff common room where she had joined the other Quidditch players reviewing the calendar for flight practices and aerial combat. People should be able to fly and cast a spell at the same time, and even more importantly, learn to fly away from a hex just as they did from a bludger. This was turning out to be a bit too much to ask of certain people, so they were also training them in plain old flying away very fast.
"I had to—" Ernie started,
happy that for once someone was answering him back.
"Listen."
Cho Chang had risen from her chair. A few hands made a token attempt at drawing her back, but with little effort. Her face was still marred by the black spidery lines, and it looked like she would have them forever. She had a right to her anger.
"You did what you did, and it's time you take responsibility for it and look for atonement instead of forgiveness. You were threatened. I was threatened too. My family was threatened. I had to cut ties with them publicly so they wouldn't be in danger. Mariette was threatened, and she's in Azkaban, Macmillan. My best friend was arrested and sent to Azkaban. Cedric is in exile. And even there, he's helping raise money and spreading awareness in other countries. So you could keep telling yourself that you had no choice, but truth is, you did. And now you have to live with it."
There was no good answer to Cho's words, nothing that could be said. But Ernie, of course, didn't let that deter him because he was too used to feeling like a victim. That kind of obdurate thinking was dangerous, but they could hardly spare any attention for him. There was far more worrying news.
But I liked her, Sirius said in a crushed tone, his eyes looking like a piece of cobalt.
He'd only known her for a couple of hours against the years of Remus's friendship. Even Severus had met her more times. Yet he looked now as if Severus had delivered a terrible blow.
"Sirius, I liked her a lot," he said plaintively.
As if that would help the universe to realize how wrong it was and to bring her back. He went on to detail all the reasons why he liked Teresa so much. Number one being that she had kissed Draco and left a smear of lipstick on his cheek, and Merlin knew that Draco needed all the affection he could get. She had also risked being caught by half a dozen Aurors back when that mattered, and she had hugged Sirius, and she had told them about Harry, and she had fed Harry lunch, and made sure he wouldn't be caught. And there were a few more reasons, but by then everyone was too embarrassed to keep listening.
"Black, it doesn't have to mean anything. The place was empty when Malfoy went there. It was just the body of Avery Sr. and nothing else. In fact, Yaxley had accompanied Gaspar Avery, and now he was missing too. They really couldn't say what had happened. People were looking into it, but there were so many things to look into that Severus doubted they would get very far." Despite the direness of the situation, Tonks couldn't keep the thought away. The thought was like a big fat summer fly, going in circles around her head and occasionally landing on a shoulder or near a glass. No matter how much she kept trying to wave it away, the thought never went far. The thought was, "Why, but this woman resembles Severus Snape." There wasn't much of an actual physical resemblance, Tonks should know. In order to get the best of her metamorphomagus powers, she had learned to pay attention to physical traits so she could later replicate them. This woman had a much darker skin tone. Her hair was more reddish-brown than black. Her facial features were all different, and above all, she was a woman and Snape was not. The entirely unimpressed gaze with which she was nailing Sturgis Podmore to the floor, however, was very much like Snape's. If Snape were to take Polyjuice, Tonks was sure he would look just like this woman. It was all very awkward, but Tonks couldn't help watching the scene with delight, as people often did when Snape was chewing someone else out. She may or may not have taken the form of a Slytherin student and gotten a VIP pass to some of those scoldings.
So you see, Sturgis went on helplessly, it's just best this way because...
Of course, neither Sturgis Podmore nor Daedalus Diggle were the most indicated for this job. They were good people. Tonks would never say anything against them in that sense, but they just didn't have that kind of presence that convinced people to abandon their home and run away with them. Kingsley did, and if he had stayed, he would probably have had better luck explaining things to the woman. But he had left to transport Yaxley to a secure location for interrogation. Andromeda was extremely skilled at making people tell her everything. She didn't even have to resort to torture despite being a black. So it was just Sturgis and Daedalus, who wouldn't convince a frog to eat flies. Tonks, who was recovering from her ordeal and therefore free to watch with delight and not participate, and Tonks' father, who had actually taken the woman's side and seemed to be equally enjoying the spectacle. Well, there was also Moody. Kingsley wasn't leaving them with just Diggle and Podmore and an injured Tonks in the house. However, Moody was out of the negotiations, as he was currently locked in a battle of wills of his own.
Much safer. I'm sure you agree. This safe house is very safe.
Safe, you say? Said the Muggle woman.
Tonks' father had to hide a chuckle behind his hand.
Yes,
Sturgis said with more strength, but still a pleading tone. The house was safe and they should stay there. The woman, however, wanted to go. You would think that she would be more grateful and open to the idea, considering that they had saved her life. After the Mulciber fiasco, although Tonks had gotten some useful information out of it, so fiasco was too strong a word in her opinion. Anyway, after that, the Death Eater body had decided to look back into Rosier's and Mulciber's disappearances and retrace their steps, thinking the Order might have had something to do with it since they have had something to do with their fake return. This took them to a Muggle town in the house of a completely innocent woman whose only crime had been marrying a wizard a long time ago. She was divorced now, and her ex-husband was doing well so far as Tonks had heard. A special operator, but not a Death Eater. That would be a story to tell. She shouldn't have been drawn into this. Muggles that abandoned their wizarding families weren't usually persecuted, or not yet. It was the ones that stayed, like Tonks' father, who were accused of continued corruption and sentenced to death. By their own rules, they should have let her alone. But they hadn't. How naive of them to expect them to conform to their norms. Only the Order had arrived just in time to save her and confront both Yaxley and Gaspar Avery. The latter had been half mad with hate, which made him more dangerous but ultimately easier to fight. Moody had killed him, and then they had subdued and captured Yaxley, and right after, they had taken the Muggle and her daughter to a safe place. Someone else was bound to come when Yaxley and Avery failed to return, and they didn't dare bet on how long it would be. It would be better, everyone agreed, if the Muggles weren't there when they came to investigate. Emmeline Vance had stayed behind in their place to report and maybe follow whoever came later. So it had been quite an adventure. They thought that the Muggle probably didn't understand the danger she had been in. When they arrived, she had had both Death Eaters in her backyard, and apparently she had been very insistently showing them her hydrangeas while failing to notice the deranged smiles on their faces. She might have been leaning against a big, dull shovel, nothing weird about it.
Safe from who?
She asked, now looking at Sturgis as if he were a used and bitten dog toy.
Well, you know.
Do I?
And his followers. Who, the Beetle Maniacs?
This time Ted Tonks couldn't contain his laughter, which came to prove the woman was being deliberately obtuse. She had to know about you-know-who if she had been married to a wizard. Tonks was very intrigued by the girl, the little Muggle girl. Not so little, perhaps, well around Tonks' usual height, but young. Once you are past 25, everyone looks very little to you, even people in their 40s. The little Muggle girl had gone to get a glass of water just as Moody was coming down that same corridor. It was narrow. Someone needed to give way so the other could pass. Usually that someone was whoever had come across Moody, because Moody used his unfortunate face without compunction to get whatever he wanted. Tonks had seen him use that creepy eye of his to bully Diggle into surrendering the last sausage at Molly's breakfasts many times. It took some time knowing him, plus massive bravery, Kingsley, or cheerful nonchalance, Tonks, to grow some immunity to him. After all, Moody was a badass, a hard and toughened fighter. It was just natural to feel intimidated in his presence. The little Muggle girl was looking at him as if he were personally responsible for some terrible insult. Moody was being moody and trying to scare her into a corner. Neither was giving an inch of space. From time to time, one of them would growl, "Move," and the other would snarl back, "No." They had no idea what had prompted it. They just knew that neither of them were backing up. Perhaps the little girl had felt intimidated, and this was how she dealt with her fears. Who knew, who knew? All Tonks knew now was that they were not relenting, and they were still engaged in an epic stare-down. Even after Ted had succeeded in convincing the mother to stay in a different house with Arthur, Tonks wasn't sure the Muggle had won until the end of the week. Fine, Tonks might have an idea, because the little girl was probably 17 or 18, Harry Potter's age in any case. And she had lived 5 minutes away from the cottage where Lupin had hidden him. It was a wild guess, very black, her father would say, but Tonks thought that out of the ministry party that went to arrest Lupin and rescue Harry, Hagrid, Dumbledore, and Moody would be the most recognizable. It had seemed very sensible at the time, very necessary, but the mission could have gone smoother and cleaner. Tonks understood that perhaps they hadn't left a very good impression with the locals. That maybe, from their perspective, Harry hadn't been rescued, even if he totally had been. It was a weekday like any other, and it was after lunch. 1 minute Percy was sitting at his desk reviewing a law proposal for the minister to sign, and the next he was on the floor having convulsions. His legs were jerking, his hands had seized and were cold and twisted like hooks. He stopped breathing for a few seconds. He had the mother of all visions. He came back, breathing hard and covered in cold, clammy sweat. His jaw ached from how hard he had closed it. He felt as if his stomach had been put inside out. He blinked for a couple of seconds, and the magical green lights of the lamps wavered. He went down again. This is the problem with prophecies. They're all right as long as you let them be and don't try to contradict them, but the future is hardly defined and unavoidable. Percy knew this very well. He had made hundreds of prophecies now, and then he had worked diligently to make sure they weren't fulfilled. This in turn opened new possibilities, new events, new prophecies to make. His brain was now seeing, in the interval of a few seconds, all the things that were going to happen in 2 days' time, plus all the things that could happen if he were to change anything. It was far too much information for one single mind, too many options from which to unravel the one single thread that would bring the best outcome. After the second attack, Percy stayed on the floor, breathing carefully and marveling at how the hard marble floor could feel warmer than his own skin. There was a small crowd of people gathered around him, looking down with worried expressions. Carter was kneeling with a glass of water in his hands, and Sullivan was in the background, exclaiming that the junior assistant to the ministry had been poisoned. Percy took the water Carter offered him and patted his arm to drag himself to the bathroom. He remembered Harry saying once, probably to Ron, that fainting was not the quick, nice process you saw in books and something called TV. Fainting involved having your digestive system reset itself and being nauseous and getting horrible gas, plus a dry mouth and the worst kind of cold sweat. Harry had fainted a lot during his third year with the Dementors, but he hadn't complained or whined about it. It had been the year when Percy had to study for his newts and prepare for his brilliant future, but still he had noticed that Harry Potter, source of problems as he was, never complained. He felt bad and he fought everybody, but he was not one to sit crying uselessly, and Percy had felt so, so sorry for him. That poor kid. It would be extra work, but Percy would make sure that he got at least one parent alive at the end. He wasn't sure how, because he had seen them die and die and die again. Such deaths, too. No wonder his stomach was so upset. But he would get him at least one. He would like to get both, of course. In fact, Percy would like to save everyone, but right now, standing in front of the sink in the ministry bathroom, waiting for his stomach to decide if it was going to belch or to throw up, Percy didn't fool himself. They might not win, They might have to call it a win simply because Voldemort was dead, even if it required 100 lives and sacrifice. Win for Percy was an empty word. He had seen many of those wins, and he hadn't liked them at all. He had even seen an outcome in which Voldemort died, but his cause lived on anyway. Percy's face and hands and back were cold and clammy, covered with a sticky kind of cold sweat that was the worst thing Percy had ever experienced. He had never liked sweating. He liked yoga because it was a slow exercise with no sweat. The sweat he got on the rare occasions he played Quidditch with his brothers or roughhouse with his roommates in Gryffindor Tower or helped dear Oliver practice his feints, that sweat was 1,000 times better than the cold, dead thing that was now over his body. He sat down on the floor, resting his temple against the side of the sink. The cold porcelain helped abate the pulsing in his head, a pressure so hard that he could barely see. He now knew that it would be then when the twins, but not just them, not just one of them, others too, so many others. Lupin and Black, who had been watching over the twins, and Snape, who took the refugees Percy sent his way, and Hagrid and Tonks, who was in the same year as Charlie and would occasionally become redhead so she could mix with the Weasley clan, and a girl named Millicent Bulstrode that Percy barely remembered, and that tiny Gryffindor who used to follow Harry Potter around, and that other Gryffindor girl with the smile and the headband, and many other people Percy didn't know. And in some versions, the worse versions, Percy did something to save them, and he did it only for them to die a few minutes later, and then someone else would die too. Minerva McGonagall, even if she looked like a force of nature, and Professor Flitwick, and Ginny, dear Merlin, Percy had to lie down again at the thought of losing Ginny too. She was not supposed to die. Not unless Percy tried to save that other girl, and then Ginny would be in the absolutely wrong place, ready to be killed by Rabastin Lestrange. She would die because Percy tried to save some other girl, someone else's sister. Percy had a very upset stomach and a tingling sensation down his arms, so he was allowed to feel very sorry and small for the next 15 minutes. He was not allowed to cry because he was in the toilets of the ministry, but he could feel sorry. Then he was going to splash some water over his face and rinse his mouth out, and he was going to grab onto that fool Sullivan's cry of having been poisoned and launch an investigation that would hopefully keep a few people distracted. He was going to take his pale face and the deep shadows under his eyes, and he was going to use them to once again be dismissed from work for the next few days. In fact, although he didn't know this yet, Percy looked so bad that the minister himself was going to offer him use of his fireplace so he could get home. Percy would politely decline because his stomach was far too jostled already. He would go to St. Mungo, though, at the minister's insistence. He would go and stay there because he needed to keep the appearance that he did not know what had come over him. He would sit there while they prodded and tested, and as he laid down on the bed, he was going to take a deep breath and he was going to think, start sorting his thoughts in an orderly manner. He had time. Not much time, but there was some. And like hell was Percy getting anything less than the best possible outcome. Never mind his previous melancholic and defeatist mind frame and 10,000 possible different futures be damned, he was getting the good one. He had an inkling that it would be the one with an aftertaste of mint and chocolate and coffee. Hogwarts had many wards and protections. It had been built with the idea that Muggles posed a threat to the wizarding children in there. Or that's what was said and repeated. If one were to be more historically accurate, then we could say that Muggles, pureblood wizards, goblins, giants, hags, vampires, and that Italian woman who thought she was a princess had all at some point attempted to do some damage to Hogwarts. They had built more protections over time, and given their history, those protections focused on keeping people out more than they did in keeping people in. This doesn't mean that leaving Hogwarts was easy, because it was not. This is to explain how difficult it was to get inside Hogwarts now. Even if you could shake off the spell that sent Muggles away, originally cast by the Founders circa 10th century, there was also a standard charm pushing people off the border, 17th century, right during the talks about the Statute of Secrecy, plus another one that made it so that the 3 steps to cross the line took the same time and effort as traversing a whole moor. Date and caster unknown, rumored to be Merlin despite it being historically impossible. This was without counting the spell laid by the Karos, Electo mostly, she was really good, that simply barred any humans from leaving or entering the grounds, and since it had been cast by them, it was particularly vicious in its application. However, Roma Santa was a monster, This wasn't bragging on his part, or exaggeration from the people he had fought, tortured, and killed. No, he actually had a special card that said so. Creature of near-human intelligence, it read, and in the line below, mixed breed. And it would be great to say that he had received it with the new regime, but he had actually possessed it long before that, when Fudge was still minister. Romasanta had a werewolf's physical strength and endurance, plus the troll's resistance to magic and a bit of giant to enhance everything. He was also, as already stated, an idiot, and in this case it was an advantage. While a reasonable person would know that there was no point in trying to force his way through the spells and that they should look for a better alternative, Romasanta was like a drill or a hammer, convinced that with enough strength he could do it. The spell against Muggles had little to do against him. The 17th century charm pushing people away worked, but Romasanta was too big and strong to let some magical force push him away. It just felt like a strong gust of wind. If crossing the line took hours and a lot of energy, if you were to feel despair as you walked and walked and didn't seem to get any closer, that was for the high people who gave orders and had thoughts. Romasanta didn't question it. He just tilted his head down and pushed forward. He had an objective, and that was enough. The spell of the Keros had more effect. He felt it fall over his skin, sink down on his muscles and sinews, and pull this way and the other. But there was a little of human in Romasanta, and if that human part of him felt a pain that was like a torment, if there was a wave of agony surging up with every step he took, it wasn't anything extraordinary. He was used to pain, and all the other non-human parts of his being were strong enough to keep him moving forward. It was hard and painful, and he sweated and bled for it, but in the end he got to the other side of the border all the same. He got inside, and after all those protection spells, there was just a forest in which Romasanta was but another creature. One of the strongest, too. Percy arrived home late, after having spent some interminable hours in St. Mungo's. Not surprisingly, they hadn't been able to give a diagnosis, and they had just recommended some rest, which was what people always told Percy whenever he complained of any ailments. Don't study so much. Get yourself outside. Rest. Whatever. He did not have time to rest. He wasn't sure he had time to plan. The time in St. Mungo's had been less fruitful than expected. He hadn't done much thinking, but he had at least sorted his thoughts and visions into some semblance of order. This meant that now he knew where to start to look, even if it meant that he had to, one, look, two, understand the workings and consequences of what he was seeing, and three, plan accordingly, four, enact said plan. He came home carrying a bag of crisps. He put it on the kitchen counter and he began to do the dishes slowly, by hand. Why he did them by hand when he was a wizard, he didn't know. He didn't even feel like doing the dishes, he just felt like he had to. It was good to do some things without using his wand. This was a thought for later, look further into it. When he was done, he undressed slowly and put his clothes, all of them, into a corner. A different one from the laundry corner. He didn't want to wear those clothes ever again. He thought they reeked of vomit, true, and to death. Not true. He went to the shower. Percy stayed there exactly 15 minutes. He had put an alarm clock by the bottle of gel to avoid dawdling too much under the warm spray. This was exactly the kind of thing Percy did, allot himself some time and observe it and be precise and effective in every action, even during leisure time. He got out, dried himself off, got dressed, forgot to put product on his hair. He opened the bag of crisps and got an emergency Coke from his fridge. Coke was hands down the absolute best remedy for an upset stomach. Percy knew because he had had some very difficult 4 years, and he had tried everything. Calming potions gave him nausea now. He ate the crisps, unflavored, only salt on them, and drank the Coke, and he tried to do as the yoga teacher said and make his brain go to white. Of course, usually you did this while seated in lotus pose or savasana, not while sitting cross-legged next to your couch. Percy just liked sitting on the floor better rather than on the couch. Most of the time he used the couch as a backrest. You certainly didn't bring snacks for meditation. Never mind that, his way worked better. Percy ate the crisps slowly and relished each and every one of them. At the moment there was a very high chance that it would be the last time he got a treat. Even if Percy survived, and he had better chances than most, how was he supposed to eat and laugh ever again? How was he supposed to go on? If he survived, but the others didn't, he just wouldn't be able to enjoy a treat. He was down to 13 hours before it happened, and no matter how he looked at it, there was no way to stop it. 13 hours, and then a full day after that before he heard and began to act. And of course his visions were very detailed about what would happen then, but they were blurry and confusing about the closer events that would trigger everything. He knew about the disaster, but he didn't know how to stop it, how to avoid it happening. If he focused and was very, very lucky, he might know how to divert it and turn it around. Perhaps, maybe. But the thing with those idiots, he couldn't stop that. He simply saw no way. It was like seeing someone mess up a potion. You couldn't stop them from blowing their cauldron under their face. But you could maybe avoid the boiling brew falling over your head. That night, Harry had a nightmare. It was a very interesting nightmare. He was in a long and narrow kitchen, so narrow that he could hardly turn around, but miles and miles long. Draco had come and demanded he make him some banana ice cream, and while Harry had found the milk, he could not find the bananas, and he ran and ran around the kitchen while Draco huffed and puffed in the background and said he was going to report Harry to Victor Crumb.
"I don't even like bananas that much," Draco said when Harry woke him to tell him.
"Neither does Victor, if I remember correctly," mumbled Hermione from her position by the window. She went on to inform them that Crumb had seemed fond of desserts with berries and nuts in them. Harry was still a bit tense and upset for having had to run around failing to find an important thing and disappointing Draco in the process. He was also oddly content because he felt that as weird as it was a normal person nightmare. Absolutely no genocide or grotesque transmutations in it. The funny thing was that they were not sleeping that well. Far worse than in Grimald Place, where despite the coldness and hardness and general unwelcome feeling, plus all the creatures in there. Draco and Harry had slept soundly from the very first night. Now they were in Diagon Alley, which was arguably a bit less cold and hard, and sleeping there was awful. There was too much noise and movement, and the walls were too thin. They had resorted to sleeping in turns and having someone always on watch, because that was the only way the two others could relax enough to fall asleep. Given all the inconveniences, it might have made more sense if they returned to Chillington or any other village of their choosing. They could stay in a house in there instead of in an abandoned shop, and they wouldn't have to move to a new place every day. As it was, most of the abandoned houses in Diagon Alley were being reappropriated fairly quickly, so they had to use empty businesses, and there were too many people around for them to feel comfortable staying two nights at the same place. They didn't like Diagon Alley, but it had its advantages. If they weren't there, they would never have learned that the black and green flag that Gringotts and some of their businesses occasionally flew was meant to signal the presence of Voldemort in the city, a symbol of the people's welcome. They had also discovered that there was a submarket that dealt with Death Eater tracking, knowing where to go so you could meet someone and maybe ask them for a favor. There was lots of information in there, enough that it made it worthy to stay. They wouldn't have to wait for long in any case. There would be more movement during the festivities, solstice, Yule, then Christmas, and the New Year, so even with vigilance they could travel north without drawing attention. It made sense to go to Hogwarts next, even if they were also thinking on how to get close to the snake. It seemed that Voldemort kept it by his feet, so it was no big leap of thought. Horcruxes that weren't tangled in the Dark Lord's skirts were to be destroyed first, so Hogwarts, which would be a long trip even if they went by broom. Draco thought that with money and patience they could retrace the steps he had taken when he left with Sirius and Remus, but since that required getting very close to some very dangerous individuals, they were taking it slowly and preparing a backup plan for the inevitable betrayal they would find. Besides, none of them were in a rush to get to the school. Subconsciously, it felt as if once they returned they wouldn't be allowed to leave again, and even Hermione had some trouble with that.
"What I could have is a cheesy omelette for breakfast," said Draco, knowing too well that they would be lucky if Harry managed to conjure some fresh fruit to go with yesterday's leftovers. It took Romasanta all night to get across the Forbidden Forest. He wasn't tired or hungry, though. He could go for long periods without sleep, and he was far from a picky eater, so anything would do. He had been delayed a little bit, but while he fought a big ugly spider which didn't provide him with much meat for the nasty way it fought, but he snacked on its carcass anyway, there had also been some nasty river creatures that tried pulling him into the water and drown him, but after he broke the second neck, they all scurried back to their burrows. He didn't get to eat any of them. He didn't come across many other monsters or animals. Truly, if it took him so long to get across, it was because he got lost easily and kept going in circles. He didn't do well alone. He didn't do too badly because he was very strong and that helped him survive, but he barely knew what he was doing most of the time. He should have crossed the forest in one-third of the time. He arrived at the open grounds around the castle just when the sun was rising, and despite his dimmed wits, he had enough sense to keep out of sight. Waiting didn't come naturally to Romasanta, and he did not have a build that was easy to hide, but Thornton had beaten into him the necessity of remaining unseen at least until he had a clear objective. There have been a couple of instances in which Romasanta didn't wait or didn't hide well enough, and their targets ran away before they could be snatched. Romasanta knew his objective. He had to find something of Snape's that he could bring back to the Lestrange woman so he could get a reward and hopefully a new master. Of course, he needed something a bit more concrete before he could act, but it didn't occur to him that he would have much trouble. Although he was as dense and thick as tar, he believed himself to be quite an expert. He had gone on many occasions with his master, and he had seen him find evidence of transgressions many times. He was sure he could do the same. As soon as he saw it, he would recognize it and snatch it, no problem whatsoever. It took him, however, quite a few hours before it began to dawn on him that the dozen of adults working around the greenhouses couldn't be students or faculty, and therefore shouldn't be there, especially the ones with Muggle clothes. It took him longer still to see that the handsome man giving an encouraging and heartening chat to the small group of students gathered by the winter flowers who were having trouble with some weird silvery spell might be the infamous Sirius Black. To be fair, the scene didn't look particularly debauched, sinful, and immoral, so Romasanta wasn't sure how he was supposed to recognize him if he didn't act as described. If that Weasley rat hadn't called him by name, he would never have figured it out. The Weasley, on the other hand, was adequately fitting to the description. Red-headed and wearing a mocking image of the Dark Lord. That Romasanta could recognize, and he knew it was wrong. Why, just a few weeks ago, when he still had a master, he had broken a wizard's arm just because he used to be friends with the Weasley clan. Then Master Thornton had stepped in and found many other reasons to punish the wizard, as he always did. That's why he was the master. Unfortunately, the Weasley friend wizard had escaped before Romasanta could tear his fingers off. They had given chase, but then there had been the ambush in which the master was injured. But the point was that that wizard had been a very bad wizard, and he wasn't even a famous one. Here they had one Weasley and one Sirius Black, who were known to be badder people or worse, whichever word was right. And this was all happening under Snape's big aquiline nose, the shame. Not that Romasanta knew such a word. If he had to describe Snape's nose, he would say it looked like a hatchet, because that was something he had seen and used frequently. Obviously, Snape was failing terribly at his work as headmaster of Hogwarts if both Black and Weasley had managed to sneak in and deceive him. Bellatrix would very much like to be able to call him on it. How embarrassed he was going to be. Everybody would laugh at his failure, and he would be sent down to perform some of the most annoying missions while they put someone much better in his place. Maybe he would be demoted so much, yet another word that Romasanta didn't really know, that he would be below Romasanta. Maybe now he wouldn't have to be the one to stand outside in the cold and rain waiting to snatch someone. Snape would be the one doing that. And Romasanta would only be called when there were actual people to chase and bite, and wouldn't that be nice? Have that dirty, nasty Snape do the ugly work and call Romasanta just for the fun. Evidently, Romasanta did not comprehend the situation. It didn't occur to him that it was impossible for Snape not to know what was happening, and that what he was seeing was proof of a betrayal and not of a failure. He had no idea of what he had discovered, but that is rarely an obstacle for an idiot ruining something. Philip didn't like Ernie very much, but he was still nice to him, or civil at the very least. He did not approve of what he had done, but he understood a little bit how scared the child must have been and how at the time he must have convinced himself that it truly was the only option. Mostly, Philip had known quite a lot of exclusion and rejection in his life, even before he became a werewolf, so he couldn't help feeling some sympathy even when Ernie had brought it all on himself. "Maybe if you show them that you're sorry," he would say. "Think of something that can make it up. They'll hate me. I don't hate you. I hate what you did." "Yeah, right. Perhaps if you showed..." "What are you even doing this? I don't need a dirty werewolf to give me life lessons." Ernie did not know a good chance when it presented itself. There were not many people who were willing to show him patience and kindness like Philip did. The most he got was some careful neutrality from teachers because it wasn't right for them to exclude him. The rest had their own stories, their own trials and moral dilemmas, their own worries to spend much time with an ungrateful snob. They weren't even actively hurting him anymore, but they certainly didn't like his company, and it was made clear that he was tolerated but not welcome. If only he picked up his wand and went to help in any of the projects, from protective clothes to medical supplies, in time, he might earn back his place between them. He might earn forgiveness, but he didn't, because it was just easier to keep complaining. There had been a sudden increase in corporeal patronae lately. Seamus had gotten one before he was done completing the movement, and it hung around the room for almost 15 minutes. Dean had cast one, too, a bit weaker but very bright nonetheless as it jumped and frolicked around Seamus's silver fox. Before that, results had been more mixed, no matter how many extra lessons Professor Lupin offered. Luna consistently got one, to general bewilderment, but it wasn't very potent. Neville had cast a corporeal one on a few occasions, but some days he could only manage a small stream of silver light. It was the same for many of them. No matter how hard they tried to focus, they simply didn't have enough spirit. Their hearts split between the present and all those that were absent and lost. Rom was good. Had always been good. When asked, because the quality and endurance of his Patronus was amazing, he said he just had to think of that pigeon message that told him that his friend was alive and that was enough. It was, funnily enough, the same technique used by Gregory Goyle. Severus had been really surprised when he heard about it and had stared at Remus for a long time in awe of his teaching prowess. Ron said that sometimes he mixed the memory with the one about the twins returning to Hogwarts after their disappearance during the summer. He feared that the memory would lose some potency otherwise, and he wanted to keep the emotion fresh. As a tip for casting a Patronus, it was good. Better not to overuse one single memory, that was good, but the damage had been done as everybody had unconsciously glanced in Ernie's way. Ron's most powerful and joyous memory was hearing that Harry and Hermione were alive. It was hard not to remember about Ernie's part in it. They had all looked at him with empty eyes or with accusing stares, and some even with pity. And Ernie did not deserve pity. Do not dare pity him. He had done nothing wrong. He had protected his family. He should not be pitied for that. He should be admired. They had a small break after class, and Ernie went outside, away from everybody and their stupid stares. It was cold, and he could feel his nose and ears going red. But it was just easier staying out there rather than going back inside and enduring everyone's presence. It's not like they would tell him off for missing class. They were very strict this year. Classes were super hard, and there were many extra lessons in the evening, so that they hardly had any time to themselves. But Ernie knew nobody would care if he skipped them. The lessons were not for him. They were for the people who wanted to fight against the dark arts, as if that would get them anywhere. As if having a freaking half-blood werewolf teaching them wasn't a bigger problem. The other werewolf, Philip, came to him now. He was often outside, taking care of inventory, checking how many plants and ingredients they had at a time. People liked him. He didn't mix much with students, but people liked him. "Here," he said now as he handed Ernie a scarf. He stopped just for a couple of seconds, looking at Ernie with a calm and serene gaze before walking away. He had learned not to expect any thanks from Ernie. Philip left to check on the mandrakes in Greenhouse 7 and then the bushes in the tree line behind. The bushes weren't very interesting by themselves, other than because they housed a colony of flying buzznaps and their droppings had some use or another. Ernie didn't care. He put on the scarf because it was cold, but he sulked about it. The next lesson of the day had started by now and the grounds were almost empty. It was just Ernie feeling angry and sorry for himself and fat as something horrible occurring and him fixing it or coming out on top in any case and how everyone would come crawling to him begging for forgiveness. It was a nice daydream that he imagined often and he got much comfort from it. He was just imagining how he would turn Cho Chang away when she begged for his help when Ernie heard a scuffle and a scream cut short. You didn't hear much screaming in Hogwarts nowadays, not unless the twins were playing with the first and second years. He went to investigate what it was. He saw. He made up his mind very, very quickly. You know what he chose. "What, if I may ask, are you two doing?" said Draco, cheeks still flushed from the cold outside, as he returned with the bags containing their lunch and dinner. Harry and Hermione looked up from the display of books they had on the table. They had twin, carefully curated, blank and guileless expressions. Very good, but not so good as to fool a Slytherin. "Because it doesn't look to me like you're collecting wand samples or making an amulet for the trip up north," Draco continued. To be fair, Harry still had an old potion set open next to him. He was supposed to find and sort anything that Draco could use for a wand, while Hermione wanted to see if she could make something to repel Dementors. Harry's Patronus might be well known by now, and they were expecting to come across some of them if the rumors from the bakery could be trusted. The open books over the table were not necessary for either task. "He wants us to know if vampires can get sick," said Hermione, the traitor, pointing at Harry. "And I didn't know the answer." Harry raised his brows slightly and widened his eyes in an attempt to express that it was a valid question.
You won't find the answer in Beaufort and Mitchell, Draco noted, sitting down.
Maybe some German author. They do have a higher number of vampires over there.
You've read Beaufort and Mitchell?
The book was dreadfully dense and thick, and it was divided into three volumes. Hermione had looked at it once when she figured out that Slytherin's monster was a basilisk and never again. If it had any academic value, it was in that it pushed people to look for other sources.
Barely, but it got popular in Slytherin during the fourth year. The general agreement is that it is more exhaustive than useful.
It was, so they closed the book and went back to work while Draco put the food away and checked on the wards around the shop's entrance, a bookstore this time, but more focused on selling quills and parchment than any decent selection of books. In the background, Harry explained his theory that all beings that feed were susceptible to disease, and therefore vampires should have some sort of common cold. Later they would have lunch, and in the evening they would make a bed, and the next morning they would move to a new hiding place and so on until they felt ready to go. Because they thought that they could go when they felt ready and not when the situation pushed them. Lachlan Romasanta had found something, and he had also been found. Being found could be a problem except for how he had acted quickly and grabbed the man's foot, not really a man though, but a werewolf, before he could give the alarm. He would have broken his neck right away and hidden the corpse in the bushes except that the master had told him not to. That's right, Romasanta had gone and found a master all by himself. He was not a very good master, he looked too young, and he used very long words, but he had just the right tone. He told Romasanta not to kill the werewolf, who was even now struggling, and that they should go right away to inform the other Death Eaters. What they had to tell him, he didn't really understand. The new master spoke of Snape being a traitor, and while Romasanta could understand the idea of failing an order and not doing a good job, the old master always let him know when that was the case, he just couldn't wrap his mind around the idea of deliberately not following an order. Why would anyone do that? Still, he felt like he now had two pieces to present to the Lestrange woman, and she could choose which one she liked best. Romasanta was now thinking that it wasn't really up to him to explain Snape's failures. It was enough to bring someone who could do it for him. The werewolf had been carrying a piece of parchment, so he must be educated. Bellatrix could ask him if she didn't understand Romasanta's new master. He hoped he didn't keep this master for long. He seemed too anxious. But he did know how to orient himself. That was a clear advantage right there. Going back through the forest with an adult werewolf over his shoulder, punched into submission so he would stop struggling, should have been harder. If not for the added weight, Romasanta was big and strong, because he needed both hands free to think in which direction to go. But the new master could look at the sun and tell which way to go, so they reached the end of the forest in little time. There was a slight problem, though. Here's the thing. Romasanta hadn't stopped to give much thought to why and how he had managed to get through the wards around the castle. He simply walked through and didn't question the mechanics. Because he didn't, neither did Ernie. Stupidity is contagious. The spell laid by Electo Caro should keep all humans away. It had been cast to keep people out as much as keeping them in. But Romasanta had little human blood, and he was so used to pain in any case that he was able to push forward just as he had done coming in. Philip, who had woken an hour ago, had hoped that the spell would push him back, that maybe he could escape simply because he couldn't be dragged anymore. But the monster was grabbing him tight, and his lycanthropy was enough to let him squeeze through the tendrils of the spell, even if he passed out with pain. Ernie was just a plain human. Pure-blooded, he might say, but it turned out in this situation it did not make any difference. He stepped forward right after Romasanta, and his heart was beating so fast that it was enough to drown Philip's pleas to reconsider and not do this. He still had time to go back, as if he was not going back. Philip was wrong. He knew what he was doing. It was not a mistake, and he wouldn't regret it. Philip wasn't wrong. Usually the wards around the castle would have pushed him back, as they used to do with Harry, preventing him from stepping forward. But now there was also Electo's spell over them, and they interacted weirdly. Ernie was able to step right into the charm barrier. It felt like a very thin layer falling over his skin, curling over itself as it enveloped his flesh and then lifting slightly. It felt as if being surrounded by the most delicate kind of shroud, only for it to transform into barbed wire. Romasanta was sweating with effort and bleeding slightly. If only Ernie had stopped to take a good look at him, if only he had considered even for a second that perhaps the big man's natural state wasn't so dirty, that he must have gone through something before meeting him in the grounds, and that he might have thought better about this. He might have survived. But Ernie hadn't thought about anything other than getting away from Hogwarts and finally earning a sweet, sweet reward from Voldemort. Even now, while he felt as his flesh was torn away from his bones, as he felt the sting of salt and blood over open cuts, all he could think was that Romasanta was crossing, was getting away. And he wasn't, so he had to keep trying. He kept trying over the pain that went to his nerves and sinews and rattled his bones. He kept trying even when he felt his blood heating up and beginning to boil. He kept trying, and he barely got a few centimeters forward. And the spells tightened over him, pushing him back and down. And there was a burnt smell now, and it was coming from him. He fell down on his knees and then on his face, with a hand extended after Romasanta. He didn't have any eyes with which to see as Romasanta crossed with an unconscious Philip and got away. He stayed behind, right on the border, and he died there. End of chapter 18.
For the full text of this and other stories by the same author, visit the AO3 and Tumblr pages of Endrina. First pass editing by Ohana. Music by Sean Johnson. Special thanks to Sakiko. If you would like me to record a story, voiceover, or character, please get in touch with me using the contact information found on my website, which is located at samgabrielvo.com. There you can also find all the other stories that I've read, as well as links to my Discord server, where I record things live for your enjoyment. And finally, as always, thank you for listening.